What role did the Trump administration's opposition toward Iran play in the president's recent visits to Saudi Arabia and Israel? Why did President Trump authorize a $300 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia? Why did the Secretary General of the United Nations and other international authorities denounce and repudiate a recent report documenting evidence of Israel's apartheid-like policies toward the Palestinian people? How effective has the boycott, divestment, sanction campaign been in addressing violations of international humanitarian law within Israel and the occupied territories? How is the Palestinian prisoners' hunger strike likely to affect changes both within the Israeli penal system and beyond? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we examine the evolving Israel-Palestine situation on the occasion of President Trump's visit and what it means for the Middle East region as a whole. We will hear from political writer and commentator Richard Silverstein, author of the blog Tikkun Olam, and we'll hear from Professor Emeritus Richard Falk, scholar and author of a recent report identifying Israel's practices towards Palestinians as apartheid. On this week's program, Trump's visit to Israel, prospects for peace and justice in the Middle East. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 26, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Obviously, yes. Leave the family themselves alone. Don't contact them, don't harass them, leave them be. But if Rich was the DNC leaker, the life of every single living organism on Earth may depend upon the public gaining access to that knowledge. This is infinitely more important than one family's feelings about American public discourse. If there's even the slightest chance that these dangerous escalations can be drawn down by the public learning that Russia was not the source of the DNC leaks, no one on Earth has any business telling us to stop looking into that possibility. So keep talking about Seth Rich. That comes from the article, The Assassination of Seth Rich, the DNC Emails and the Russia Probe, Why You Should Definitely Keep Talking About Seth Rich, by Caitlin Johnstone, posted May 25th, originally appearing at medium.com. FDR and Stalin shared all kinds of information. And by the way, some Russians complained to me that Stalin was never demonized in the US media the way Vladimir Putin has been. And Stalin killed millions of people. The bait and switch that I mentioned earlier, beginning with the story that Russia decided the U.S. presidential election, then switching to all these other crimes that have some sort of connection to Russia, any connection to Russia, is creating this atmosphere where not just the Russian government, but the Russian people are identified as enemies of the United States. A people is not a government, and a government that has flaws does not typically see those flaws improve in response to threats, sanctions, attacks, or lies about it. That was an excerpt from David Swanson in conversation with Ann Garrison under the headline, Never Mind the Real Russia, This Is All About Trump. Posted May 25th, originally appearing at Black Agenda Report. Putin is a Democrat, not an authoritarian. The authoritarians are in Washington. Surely Paul Street and Counterpunch know this, but Street has to protect himself from speaking some politically incorrect truths about the US and Russia by throwing in some anti-Putin propaganda and denigrating President Trump. That peace with Russia and China would undermine the justification of the $1,000 billion military security budget, and that the military security complex is the American government, is too much truth for most writers to state. That comes from the article, Truth Has Become Un-American, by Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 24th, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. Clearly, we are all supposed to hate and ridicule Vladimir Putin. He is being demonized as the new quote-unquote enemy in much the same way that George Orwell foresaw in his dystopian novel 1984. Yet, what is perhaps most troubling is that the major U.S. news outlets, which played instrumental roles in demonizing leaders of Iraq, Syria, and Libya, believe they are engaged in some quote-unquote golden age journalism, rather than writing propaganda. Yes, I realize that many good people want to see Trump removed from office because of his destructive policies and his buffoonish behavior, and many are eager to use the new bête noire, Russia, as the excuse to do it. But that still does not make it right for the U.S. news media to abandon its professional responsibilities in favor of a political agenda. That comes from the article, U.S. Journalism's New Golden Age, by Robert Perry, posted May 24th, originally appearing at Consortium News. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Protests, a lucrative arms deal, selfies with Knesset members, a visit to the Western Wall, and rhetoric directed against Iran were all notable highlights of Donald Trump's first visit abroad as President of the United States. He first stopped in, of all places, Saudi Arabia, lavishing praise on one of the most despotic and repressive regimes on the planet. Then in Israel, he was welcomed by Benjamin Netanyahu and invited to speak at the Israel Museum. He was optimistic about prospects for a lasting peace between Palestinians and Israelis, with Saudi Arabia, not Iran, playing a role in the process. To give us an overview of the trip and some of the dynamics in play, I spoke with an Israel watcher whose blog has focused for nearly 15 years on exposing the excesses of the Israeli national state. Richard Silverstein is a political writer based in Seattle, Washington. He authors the progressive blog Tikkun Olam, and he contributes regularly to Middle East Eye. He's also contributed to Truthout, Alternet, Haaretz, Mint Press News, Jewish Forward, Los Angeles Times, Comment is Free, and Al Jazeera English, among other publications. Mr. Silverstein, thank you for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
I'm delighted, and thanks for the invitation.
Now, going back a bit, Trump had made a big deal during the campaign about the Iran nuclear deal being a bad deal. And we know that the Saudis and the Israelis also disagreed with that deal. So I'm wondering what role would you say Iran may have played as a motive behind Trump's visits this week, first to Saudi Arabia and then to Israel?
Well, what's interesting, I think, about all of this is that Israel and Trump seem to work on a philosophy of finding an enemy, a common enemy, to unite against. And that was true of his campaign, of course, his election campaign. And it's also true in terms of what's going on now in the Middle East, because Israel and Trump have put forward Iran as the bête noire, the demon that everyone can unite against. Of course, not everyone can unite against Iran, but in their worldview, they feel they can unite enough of the Middle East against Iran to create this unified entity, which would include Israel, the United States, and the Sunni states of the region, and they unite against Iran. The problem, of course, with this sort of demonization is, A, that it will create many, many dead, because it will lead to a religious war between Sunnis and Shia, and also that it just won't solve any of the larger problems in the region. It only distracts from them, and the primary one being the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And for Bibi Netanyahu of Israel, that is one of the primary motives for him to use Iran as this demon, because it will distract the world from pressuring Israel into resolving that very important conflict.
Saudi Arabia is well known as a financier of Wahhabist sects that fuel extremist activity, including groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. As well, Saudi Arabia has been pummeling Yemen for the last year. There's an estimated 10,000 civilians who have been killed as a result of that conflict. So what are your thoughts about this $300 billion or so arms deal? Where is that money going, and who principally will benefit from it?
Well, a very important issue, and I think it really goes to the heart of the hypocrisy of the Trump administration dealing with this issue. Their claim is that Donald Trump several times has said he's a peacemaker. His goal is to make peace. I think he told the Pope that before he left Rome. And it's all a charade because these arms are going to be used to kill Muslims. They won't be used to kill Sunni Muslims, although they will die as well. They'll be used mostly to kill Shia Muslims in places like Yemen and Bahrain and other places in the region. So this is a huge arms race, and Trump is happy to fuel the arms race, naturally. And I should add that Trump is only the latest American president to do this, because all of our presidents, including Obama, have given huge amounts of weapons to the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia. So the idea that you can fuel an arms race and broker peace at the same time is not only foolhardy, it's just about criminal, I would say.
You mentioned that there's not much of a serious divide between Trump and Obama or previous presidents when it comes to that Shia Sunni divide. Is it really simply a question of smoke and mirrors? I mean, just a different mask, or is there maybe something a little bit different about...
Oh, yes. I didn't mean to say it quite that way. I was talking more about funding on arms race in the region and Obama being willing. He gave Saudi Arabia $100 billion worth of arms in the course of his 8 years in power. So that's all I was talking about. I think there is a definite distinction between Obama's policy in the region and towards Iran and Trump's. Trump's view is that Iran is pure evil, and Obama had a much more nuanced and sophisticated approach to Iran that led to the P5+1 nuclear deal. And I believe that if there had been a Democratic president elected, that this likely could have been built upon to normalize relations with Iran. Of course, there's no way to know for sure what would have happened, but I think that the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is that Democratic presidents seem to be more willing to explore the idea that Iran is not evil incarnate, and that it might be a state like all other states, and one that could be negotiated with and diplomatically resolve disputes, which of course we do have with Iran. But so there is, I think, a distinct difference between those two approaches.
Do you see any, I feel like I'm putting it in a fairly gruesome way, but looking at the economic spin-offs of this deal, I mean, is it merely a geostrategic calculation, or is there a prospect of economic benefits, American jobs any other such considerations?
Well, I think that there are minor considerations, whereas Trump is trying to turn them into major considerations, of course, because there will be American workers who will build these weapons and develop them, so there will be a benefit to our economy. But I think in the long run, the largest benefit to our economy would be normalizing relations with Iran, because Iran, if you want to speak purely in economic terms, it's a market of 70 million people. It's a country which is technologically sophisticated, well-educated. The majority of the society is young. That's true maybe of Saudi Arabia as well, but those countries are really quite stultified, and in terms of economic development, they're quite primitive. They only have basically one product to export, and that's oil, whereas Iran has many different possibilities for trade and commerce and exchange, cultural exchanges, and all sorts of other things. So my feeling is that Iran is... I don't want to overemphasize this because we do have disputes with Iran, but I do believe in general the future of the region is in terms of, you know, where the greatest impact will be is Iran as opposed to Saudi Arabia. Those Saudi states are dictatorships. They're closed societies. They're misogynist and homophobic societies. So they have values that are totally at odds with Western democracy. And while Iran obviously has elements in its society which are similar, it also has a very strong democratic impulse and tradition, and that's really what we should be encouraging.
I wanted to just get some of your thoughts about the some of the media coverage. I feel like I've seen his visit to the Western Wall, like pictures a dozen times over the last 48 hours. I'm wondering, in your opinion, should observers read anything into that more than just some benign act of respect for his hosts? Is there a specific, some nonverbal message that's being communicated?
Well, we've had all American presidents, virtually all, visit the Western Wall when they visit Israel. So I wouldn't read too much into this. But the pictures of every single member of his entourage, all the major Secretary of State and the Homeland Security Advisor and everyone and their brothers seemed to be lined up there paying their respects at the Western Wall. So that really was over the top, as much of Trump's administration is. It's kind of a fawning, showing fealty to Israel that, to my mind, was distasteful. And, you know, much of his trip to Israel was distasteful. There was a selfie with the MK, the member of Knesset, who was himself a morally problematic person, like Trump is. Mm-hmm. And there were just so many things that happened on that visit to Israel that were crude and gruesome. But the main way to respond to your question is that Trump has shown that he is allied with the worst political impulses in Israeli society, the most bellicose, the most violent and brutal towards the Palestinians and towards Muslims in general. And that seems to line up with his whole approach domestically as well, opposing Muslim refugees entering the country and really showing a very strong streak of Islamophobia in all of his policies.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about the way Israelis and Palestinians are looking at this Trump visit? How are they viewing Trump? Are they seeing him as some sort of a possible agent of change, for better or for worse, or just more of the same?
I think the Palestinians are viewing him as irrelevant, except for maybe the elite, like Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the PA, who I don't think can possibly see Trump as any sort of positive force. But the Palestinians are going to be hostile to Trump. And he, you know, spent a very brief amount of time in Bethlehem meeting with Abbas. Israelis, it's a little more complicated. Most Israelis are very right-wing and nationalistic, so they like Trump insofar as he supports their approach, and they like the fact that he has been sympathetic to settlements, and they like the fact that he has talked about Jerusalem as the undivided capital of Israel, and the moving of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So Israelis like all of that, but they would prefer someone who was even more acquiescent to Israeli interests than Trump, believe it or not. So I think that Israelis on the far right are going to be a little skeptical of Trump because he's not right-wing enough for them. And I think that the rest of Israelis, they've seen decades worth of presidents and secretaries of state claiming that they have the solution to the conflict or that, you know, peace is on the horizon. So I think probably the majority of Israelis are more like the silent minority of the Nixon era, in that they're waiting and they're saying, you know, talk is cheap and let's see, you know, what, if anything, you're going to do. So I don't think Trump moved the majority of Israelis either. And I think this trip had a lot of pomp and circumstance and decorative flourish, but I don't think there was any substance to it at all.
Now, we were talking at the outset about there's this peace deal that's being pursued, and Iran is being kind of used as the enemy, sort of an enemy of my enemy kind of argument. Basically, the basis of peace seems to be revolving around hostility towards Iran. It's completely excluded from the deal that's being pursued. Saudi Arabia is playing a kind of a mentoring role with the Palestinian representation. So what is your sense of the prospects for success given the established dynamics?
Well, I think we have to look at a couple of different aspects of this. I think we have to look at Palestine, Israel-Palestine, of course. We also have to look at Syria, because that's a huge hole in the map of the Middle East right now. In terms of Israel-Palestine, I think this whole idea that the Saudis are going to somehow push the Palestinians into agreeing to a deal that's also going to be acceptable to Israel is a pipe dream. I don't think that the Palestinians are going to be suckered into allowing the Saudis to be their guarantors of a peace deal, especially one that doesn't offer them much of what they want. If Israel isn't willing to withdraw to 67 borders and isn't willing to allow Jerusalem to be a shared capital of two states, and isn't willing to allow for return of refugees to Israel proper in any way, shape, or form, then it's a non-starter. I don't see how Saudi Arabia can impose itself on the Palestinians. Yes, it does provide funding for the PA, not for Hamas or Gaza, but yes, it does that. But money is not going to work in terms of compelling the Palestinians to do anything they don't want to do. And the flip side of that is that the United States would be the guarantor for the Israelis. And, we are so in bed with the Israelis now and so much not an honest broker that I don't see how the Palestinians would trust the U.S. role in this. So I think there's a lot of unexamined assumptions in the idea that the Saudis will bring peace with the United States, and trailing behind will be Israel and the Palestinians. I think it's a pipe dream. And then, the issue of the role that Saudi Arabia is playing in Syria, along with Iran on the other side, is also a really big issue. And I don't see any prospect of peace there either. I don't think that Saudi Arabia is playing a positive, constructive role in Syria. And, one could argue also that Iran isn't doing that either. So I don't, I just see more intractable conflict in the future. And I don't see that Trump is going to do anything other than allow the status quo to proceed.
Or get worse.
Well, yeah, of course, yeah. That's the thing about the Middle East. Things don't stay the same. They get worse. If they stay the same, that means they're going to get worse.
Do you see any role for Russia as far as the way things evolve in the Israel-Palestine?
Oh, that's a tough question. The Russians are so hard to read in terms of their interests and what they're willing to do and what their ultimate goals are in the region. I think if I were to prioritize the parties in terms of how constructive they could be, I really would think that the Iranians are the ones that could be the most constructive if we engaged with them in a reasonable way, which we're not, obviously. The Russians are just really hard to read. They have invested so much in undermining our U.S. election system, and they've also, made their commitment to Assad, and I don't, you know, they have been talking about ceasefires and non-conflict zones with the U.S. and other parties, but I haven't seen that really work very well. Mm. So they're hard to, you know, I hate to keep repeating myself, but I don't know the answer to that question. Okay. I would like to think that Putin and the Russians are smart enough to realize that there has to be some kind of negotiated solution in Syria, but I just haven't seen enough signs that they're willing to actually do something about it.
Mm. And on the Iranian front, and you might have to close it with this, but it seems to me that Hezbollah and Hamas, militant factions within that have been aligned with the aims of the Palestinian population, there doesn't seem to be any room in these in this peace deal for those factions, and so I'm
Yeah, that's a major weakness and flaw of this as well, because just as they want to exclude and isolate Iran, they are acting as if Hezbollah and Hamas don't exist. And that's really not only inexcusable, but it's just a recipe for disaster, because Hamas represents, almost everyone in Gaza, and it's even got a presence on the West Bank as well. And Hezbollah is a very strong force, not only in Lebanon, where it's founded, but in the fighting in Syria. So those forces really have to be taken into account. It doesn't mean that you should allow them to dictate a solution, or it doesn't mean you should allow them to be, the sticking point to preventing a solution. But it does mean that they need to be taken into account in some way, and that's the problem with a Trump-Israeli approach, an all-or-nothing sort of black-or-white approach. While I was very critical of Obama while he was in office, I think there was at least the understanding in his circle that that we slowly but surely had to come to terms with groups like Hezbollah and Hamas. We didn't have to like them in terms of our national foreign policy, but we did need to acknowledge that they existed, and we somehow needed to finesse the fact that they needed to be included in the dialogue and in the process of normalization or peace agreement. And we've lost that now, so my overall feeling is one of great pessimism. I'm sorry to end on that note, but that's unfortunately where we seem to be.
Richard Silverstein, thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
Richard Silverstein is a political writer and commentator. You can find his recent articles on his blog, Tikkun Olam, at the URL www.richardsilverstein.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Israel has long been accused of major violations of international humanitarian law on the territories it has occupied for 50 years. Trump's visit takes place in the shadow of a largely suppressed hunger strike involving over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners demanding improvements of conditions inside Israeli jails, an end to excessive use of solitary confinement, and an end to administrative detentions. I had a chance to speak to these issues with someone recognized as an expert on international law who is familiar with the human rights situation in Israel-Palestine. Richard Falk is Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University and the former United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the occupied territories. He was also the co-author of a report commissioned by the UN's Economic and Social Commission for West Asia. It was released on March 15th of this year, and it was called Israel's Practices Toward the Palestinian People and the Question of Apartheid. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Falk.
Well, I'm very happy to be with you, Michael.
Now, let's speak about the report itself. You encountered very intense denunciations, including from the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., perhaps not unsurprisingly, Nikki Haley, and also the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who had called it for it to be removed from the website. Was there ever at any point articulated to you any academic objections, factual errors or problems with the methodology, or was it simply that these interests didn't like your conclusions?
Well, it's hard to know what the basis of the rejection was, other than a pushback against anything that was perceived to be critical of Israel's policies and practices. And as far as we could tell, neither Ambassador Haley nor the Secretary General had looked at the substance of the report. It's a rather academic document that tries to look in a serious way at the evidence which relates to whether or not it is reasonable to view Israel's approach to the Palestinian people as falling within the prohibition of apartheid as an international crime. And we recognize that our conclusion was controversial, and we also felt it was important to deal with the Palestinian people as a whole and not limit the focus to those Palestinians living under occupation. So part of the originality of the report is to also address the discrimination confronting the Palestinian minority living within Israel, as well as the situation of refugees and involuntary exiles that among the Palestinian people that number around 6-7 million people. So it affects a large number of persons. And so our sense was that this language of apartheid in the title of the report was enough to create this firestorm at the UN that led the new Secretary General feeling pressure from the U.S. government at the present time because of threats to withhold substantial amounts of U.S. funding from the organization, that he seems to have felt compelled to act. Though what he did, it's important to recognize, was to seek the removal of the report from the website on the ground that improper consultation had preceded its release, and he didn't directly repudiate the substance of the report.
Mm-hmm. Now, looking at the report itself, it's a 75-page document where you talk about apartheid through fragmentation and the different methods of administration that's used to control the Palestinian populations and how that... Because, fragmentation is... it somewhat evokes what the South African experience with the Bantustans. So
yes, and we were both conscious of the analogies to the South African experience and the importance of treating the Israeli-Palestinian reality in terms of its own originality. And the international crime of apartheid makes a point of not being tied to the South African precedent. So that means, in effect, that you don't necessarily have to establish a similarity to what was done in the racist regime that existed in South Africa, but you do have to show that there was a systematic structure of domination based on racial differences that was designed to perpetuate a system of discriminatory and exploitative control. And that's what we essentially found happening to the Palestinian people as a result of the kinds of policies and practices that have been put in place by the Israeli government.
You mentioned the general category of demographic engineering, where the Jewish, where they, along you know, racial lines, they're managing to maintain a legal enforcement that says you can't challenge that existing ethnic makeup of the...
Exactly. And it's most obvious in the administration of the West Bank, which has now gone on for 50 years, and where the Israeli settler population has the benefit of the rule of law as applied by Israeli the Israeli governing process, whereas the Palestinian people who are native to that territory are subject to this prolonged military administration in which they essentially have no rights and have no legal recourse after such a long period of subjugation. And part of our thinking in the overall conception of the report is that it's no longer responsive to the reality to talk about ending the occupation. The only short way of describing the situation as in a solution-oriented way is to talk about ending apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
that is probably the biggest takeaway that we hope emerges from a reading of the study.
Are there specific structural changes that you reasonably see could be put in place that would reverse this trend?
Well, I think it's hard to envision it taking place without abandoning, in some sense, the claim of Israel to be an exclusively Jewish state and to maintain a system of control over the West Bank and Gaza and indirectly through the refugee camps of those living outside of territorial Israel and Palestine. So that what we're really saying is in effect the same thing that was said in South Africa, that it's necessary for the South African government to abandon a structure that is based on racial domination and discrimination. And that's really what we're saying to Israel. We're not threatening the existence of Israel, but we are threatening that part of its contemporary reality that rests on this set of practices that constitute apartheid.
I know that you set out a lot of recommendations in the report, or you and your co-author, Virginia Tilley. Among them, they have recommendations for the UN, for national governments, and for civil society and private sector actors. I did take note of the encouragement to embrace boycott, divestment, and sanctions activities. Boycott, divestment, sanctions has already been directed toward Israel with, I think arguably there has been some impacts. What are your thoughts about the impacts so far? That is Israel clearly responding to this, to that effort? And are we seeing some significant successful or not, pushback against the BDS campaign?
Yes, I think we're seeing a gigantic effort. An Israel think tank issued a report that 20 times the governmental funding of efforts to counter what they call the delegitimation project, the central feature of which is the BDS campaign. So that I think there are many signs they've pushed for this declaration here in the United States, where the governors of the 50 states all condemn the BDS campaign. There are also congressional initiatives, and a variety of governors and states have taken put into play other initiatives, which is, it's interesting in one way, the comparison with South Africa, because despite the South African effort to minimize the impact of the BDS campaign that existed then, there was never this attack on those that supported it that has been so characteristic of this Israeli pushback and the pushback of militant pro-Israeli NGOs, which try to smear the supporters of BDS as engaging in anti-Semitic activity and often trying to discredit, as they did with our report, the undertaking by discrediting the messenger in order to evade the message. And that, I think, has been an intensifying campaign. It's also expressed in efforts to limit activities on university campuses, both here and in Europe. And so there is, as you suggest by your question, a very significant kind of pushback. And I take it as an indication that the BDS campaign has had some important impacts.
Now, internally within Israel, I've been reading articles lately talking about the campaigns where school children are exposed to these terror drills, and a lot of the ways in which school children have been, what they're exposed to, that would seem, I take it as somehow making people sort of just accepting this violence and possibly even traumatizing them in such a way that it becomes difficult to view in a negative light the human rights abuses.
Yeah. Yes, I'm afraid that is part of this socialization process within Israel itself. And it has long been the case, I think, that Israeli leaders have used fear to manipulate their own society and keep this sense of alert at a very high level, and also to create resistance to any kind of effort at a political compromise that reaches a reasonable, sustainable peace for both Jews and Palestinians.
Yeah. So you're going against, I mean, if you're looking for practical means by which to turn the tide, you know, you're having to go up against the kind of a psychic barrier, you might say. It's not as simple as simply showing people, see, look what you're doing. This is wrong, so you've got to change it.
Well, I think that's right. And I think the reason, for instance, that I would support BDS and other means of nonviolent pressure is precisely because compelling Israeli leaders and their public opinion to recalculate their own interests, will we get a sufficient change in outlook that it might be possible to negotiate a sustainable peace.
Professor Falk, I want to bring up the Palestinian prisoners' hunger strike, you know, which has gone on for almost 40 days. I believe Marwan Barghouti, who spearheaded this strike, has been hospitalized. And there's a number of demands, and there, we're talking about pushback. I mean, there were efforts to try to get these prisoners force-fed. What successes would you say what has been achieved through this strike in terms of getting any actual concessions from Israel?
Well, as far as I know, very little. If that was the main objective, then I think one has to say that so far, at any rate, it's not been successful. But I do think there are other objectives, which is, first of all, to create a sense of resistance on the part of the Palestinian people in general that goes beyond what the grievances are of those engaged in the hunger strike itself. And I think the large display of solidarity within both Gaza and the West Bank suggests that this has had a major impact on of raising Palestinian political consciousness at a time when there were many reasons for it to feel discouraged, being bypassed by the kind of diplomacy that Trump has been pursuing in the region, and by the attitude toward Israel that the U.S. has exhibited since his election. All of these developments create a fairly widespread feeling that nothing positive on the behalf of the Palestinians is likely to happen. But I think the hunger strike has already had some impact on world public opinion and alerted people to the reality that the Palestinian struggle is something that cannot be ignored by those who want to see a humane outcome in the conflict after all these decades.
What will it do then to affect or strengthen the Palestinian politics, like internally? I mean, Fatah and those representative organizations, given it would seem the underscored, the way in which Marwan Barghouti himself has been underscored as a major player.
Well, I think that's just right. I think that Barghouti is the one Palestinian figure that seems able to transcend the divide between Fatah and Hamas, and would represent a kind of Palestinian Mandela in if the Israelis ever wanted to signal a readiness to engage in real peace diplomacy by releasing him from prison. And so his leadership of this strike is very symbolic, it seems to me, not only of the effort to improve conditions within prisons and to call attention to the violation of international standards, but also to create a climate of opinion among Palestinians that might finally lead to a greater display of Palestinian unity in approaching the international community.
Mm. Now, the Palestinian prisoner hunger strike is not, to my sense, really been covered very well or broadly by the major media. And I suppose that you might say that your own report has not been given, not unlike your own report, the kind of media coverage your own report may have gotten. To what would you attribute the media distortion around human rights and international law obligations vis-a-vis Israel-Palestine?
Well, I think that has been a characteristic of the unfair treatment of this conflict in the mainstream press and media for many years. And it represents the influence of the United States government and the rather sophisticated efforts of Israel to shape the public presentation of issues relating to Israel-Palestine, including its rather inhibiting tendency to dismiss criticism as signs of anti-Semitism, which has had a big effect, particularly in Europe, but also here in North America. And I think the corporatization of mainstream media has created this greater deference on the part of most media outlets to prevailing governing policy. So it's not a surprise to me, nor nothing new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although we do seem to see, at least within Europe, there has been an embrace of boycott, divestment, sanction. And I'm wondering if you, if through that or other mechanisms, you do see the redress of the Palestinian situation being reversed. Realistically, are we going to see something resembling the fall of apartheid in South Africa at some point?
I think it's too soon in that kind of process or development to make any sort of sensible prediction. I do think the rightward drift of Israeli politics has split the Jewish community in North America to a significant degree, though it's not reflected in governmental policies or institutions at this point. And I think that some of the Israeli defiance of international law and international public opinion and UN attempts to create a more a positive understanding of the Palestinian grievances has led some media to be a little bit more open about dealing with the conflict, and the New York Times publication of the Barghouti prison appeal at the start of the hunger strike is illustrative. Of course, it got Barghouti himself into additional trouble. He was punished, put in solitary confinement because of the publication of this opinion piece, which violated itself, violated prison rules.
I wonder if I could just get your a quick thought from you about what appears to be a tendency lately to just reject the two-state solution and go for a kind of a unitarian solution. What would that mean from the standpoint of human rights, realistically?
Well, if you add the word realistically, it's again very difficult to know how one would move from the present highly unequal relationship of the influence and leverage of the two communities to one where they were treated on the basis of equality. Because unless that ethos of equality is embedded in a political arrangement, there's no way of achieving a solution that is in accordance with human rights and any kind of just outcome. So one needs, it seems to me, you can't also find a solution within the Zionist idea that Israel is a Jewish state as distinct from being a haven or homeland for Jews, which doesn't imply the control of the state. An ethnic state is almost by definition incompatible with human rights because it means that the minority, as is the case in Israel, despite its claims of being a constitutional democracy, suffer from a variety of forms of discrimination. In Israel's case, that discrimination is practiced by treating citizens as essentially equal, but making important substantive distinctions between nationals of different ethnic identity. Thus, any Jew can come to Israel through the exercise of a right of return, where even while Palestinians, even with deep roots in the territory, are disallowed to immigrate to Israel. Well, and there are many such restrictions that are embodied in these nationality laws, including property rights and family unification, all kinds of things.
Richard Falk, I really want to thank you for your patience and sharing your unique perspectives on this situation. I appreciate having this conversation with you. Thanks again.
Good. Thank you, Michael. Good talking with you.
We've been speaking with Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University and the former United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the Occupied Territories. He recently co-authored the UN's Economic and Social Commission for West Asia report examining the argument for regarding Israel as an apartheid state. He spoke to us from Santa Barbara, California. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.